Shalom and welcome to another in our series of podcasts from Temple Beth Am, a dynamic center for conservative Judaism in Los Angeles. This is a recording of Rabbi Avi Havivi's weekly Sidur class.
We've been talking about strands of Jewish theology. We've been looking at it historically. We talked about the biblical period. Now we're talking about the rabbinic period, the sages of the Mishnah and the Talmud, Chazal, and various ideas about God. The last couple of weeks, last couple of sessions, we've been looking at ideas about God's, I'm going to call it complexity. First, we looked at God is not perceived as one particular thing, right? To the young man, he looks like a man of war, and to the baby, God sounds like something else. And then we looked at the giving of the Torah last time, and we saw various midrashim about sort of the ways in which the sages tried to understand the giving of the Torah, and we saw all kinds of conflicting ways. You know, the Torah is simultaneously translated into 70 languages. It was in the north, it was in the south, in terms of God's voice. And now this week we're gonna do kind of a corollary to that, not exactly about revelation at Sinai, but about the process of Moses receiving Torah. The idea of, as it says in Pirkei Avot, Moshe kibel Torah miSinai. Moses received the Torah at Sinai, meaning, seems to imply, the Torah was divinely revealed to Moses at Sinai. And there are many, many, many rabbinic passages that look at that idea. Where this filters into our Siddur, for sure, is second paragraph of the Shema service, the paragraph right before the Shema Ahava Rabbah, right, where we thank God for giving us the Torah. And the sages have some midrashim in which they want to address, well, what does that mean exactly, giving us the Torah? We know that that came somehow through Moses. It's called Torat Moshe. And so without further ado, I'm going to do some screen sharing. And I've brought a few texts, I think four texts today, but there's so many more that we could have brought, because there are many interesting texts about this. Okay. First, I'm going to start with what you think of as two passages that are about what we would call the classic position that we think is the official rabbinic position on Moses receiving the Torah, the classic position, which we would call some people refer to as the maximalist position. Okay. Here's just to tell you in advance what it's going to say. The maximalist position is every word of the Torah was dictated by God to Moses. Period, end of story. We assume that that is the rabbinic view. What we'll see is that's only one rabbinic view, which I'll refer to as the maximalist view. And this midrash in the Sifrei is talking about the last eight verses of the Torah, where it says, and Moses died there, and he was buried, and no one knows where his burial place, and there is no prophet like Moses. All right, so the midrash says, Efshar Shemait Moshe, v'kotei v'yamotcha Moshe, is it possible that Moses already was dead, and then he wrote, and Moses died, right? You couldn't do that. You couldn't write your eulogy after your death, right? Ella, ad kan katav Moshe, mikan v'elach katav Yoshua. Okay, the answer is actually, the whole Torah up until now was written by Moses. The last eight verses were written by who?
Joshua.
So Joshua finished the Torah that we have, saying, and Moses died there, and the rest of the last eight verses. But Rabbi Meir says, no. It says elsewhere in Deuteronomy, Vayichtov Moshe et HaTorah HaZot. Moses wrote this Torah. Efshar shenatan Moshe et HaTorah kashi chaseira afilu ot achat. Is it possible that Moses gave anything less than the entire Torah, even missing one letter? Forget about eight verses. Rabbi Meir saying, no. It says Moses brought us this Torah, which means the whole Torah. How could it mean anything less than the whole Torah? So, Milamed, this line Moses wrote, this whole Torah, teaches us, Shehaya Moshe Kotev, Masha Amarlo Kadosh Baruch Hu Katuv. I left the last part of this out. I'm sorry. Anyway, the last part doesn't add to it theologically, but it's picturesque. Rather, what it means is Moses wrote every single word that God dictated to him. And then I cut off the rest of the Midrash. I'm sorry. And it says the last eight verses, he was crying as he wrote it, right? God dictated the entire Torah to Moses, including, and Moses died there, which is part of God's Torah, which he gave to us through Moses, even though when Moshe was writing that, he hadn't died yet. And the Midrash says the last eight verses he wrote through his tears, meaning he was crying. But the entire Torah was given through Moses, even the part that says, and Moses died, in the past tense. Everyone follow that? That's kind of the classic, what we expect is the classic view. The entire Torah was given to Moses. Another passage in Tractate Sanhedrin in the Babylonian Talmud. This is a commentary on the Mishnah. I might have brought the Mishnah, but I didn't. Maybe I'll add it when I revise the sheet before I post it. The Mishnah says, anyone who denies that the Torah is from heaven has no share in the world to come. It's a list of people who have no share in the world to come, meaning you're not going to go to the world to come, which one of our members has said Judaism is not clear on what that means. And I've promised that I will have a session on the rabbinic view on what happens after death. Okay. So whatever happens after death sounds like a good thing, the world to come. But if you deny that the Torah is written by God, you have no portion in the world to come. This is the Talmud's commentary or amplification of that. Afilu amar kol haTorah kula min hashamayim, chutz mi pasuk zeh, shelo amaro hakadosh baruch hu, ela Moshe mi piatzmo, zehu ki dvar Hashem baza. There are various interpretations of the verse. This person has despised or spurned the word of the Lord. And this refers to even someone who says the whole Torah is from heaven, except for one verse, which God did not say, and Moshe himself decided to write this verse. Even one verse of the Torah isn't from God. This is a person who is called a spurner of God, meaning every single word of the Torah is from God. By the way, and even if one inference interpretation, if you say this is not from heaven, you're a spurner of God, meaning you're a non-believer. Okay? So these are two passages that express, I think, what I would call what we think of as the classic view. I don't really believe it's the classic view, because I will call it because of the, I don't know, I was going to say because of the dominance the last couple of years of, last couple of hundred years of orthodoxy. And when I say orthodoxy, I don't mean orthopraxy, correct praxis, but I mean orthodoxy, correct belief, right? And books about what is Torah true Judaism. It has come to be taken for granted that this is the sage's view, that every word of the Torah is from heaven, dictated, right? There's another passage that I didn't bring, that Moshe was like a lavlar, which means a scribe. Moses was like a secretary. Hashem dictated word for word, and Moshe wrote it down. But that's actually only one view of the rabbinic period of how the Torah that we have came to be. We actually have some different views. Okay. Here's an argument about how the whole Chumash was revealed or given. For example, in Tractate Gittin in the Talmud, Rabbi Yochanan says in the name of Rabbi Bana'a, Torah Megillah, Megillah Nitna. It was given one scroll at a time. By the way, we don't know what that means. You might think Megillah means one book of the Bible at the time, but that's generally not what the word is for a book of the Bible in the Talmud. Usually a word in the Talmud for one book of the Bible, like Exodus or Leviticus, their word is chumash. Our word chumash means all five books together. Their word chumash is one book of the Bible. And it's actually in this same section of Talmud. It's not here on the sheet, but which the question is, are you permitted to write a Torah scroll with only part of the Torah? Now, we know you're allowed to do that for tefillin. You're allowed to do that for mezuzah. But other than that, for a book to be read, right? So there's a question raised, like, if we're reading in the Torah now, in the book of Leviticus, Vayikra, which we are, correct? Would you be permitted to read that from a scroll that was only Vayikra, right? In theory, someone could write a scroll that was only one book of the Chumash. They call that a Chumash. A Chumash means one-fifth division of the Torah. And the answer is no, you're not allowed to do that. So in the context of this discussion, it says, you know, they're talking about how is the Torah given or revealed. Rabbi Yochanan, in the name of Rabbi Menachem, says, you know, it was only given one Megillah at a time, which somehow means one section at a time. It's not clear entirely what that section was. Or what's a section? Is it, you know, one piece of parchment? Is it one Parsha division? Right? But it was given in different pieces. Okay. Reish Lakish, who was always arguing with Rabbi Yochanan, they are two Eretz Yisraeli sages from the late 200s. Reish Lakish says, no, Torah Chatuma Nitana. Chatum means sealed, literally. And the context here is means, nope, it was given signed, sealed, delivered, meaning it was given as one book. Okay. As it says, take this Torah. This Torah, which seems to imply the whole Torah. And then the Talmud gets into, as it frequently does, how come Rabbi Yochanan doesn't agree with Reish Lakish, and how come Reish Lakish doesn't agree with Rabbi Yochanan, right? Rabbi Yochanan, how does he respond to the verse saying, take this Torah, which seems to imply that's one book? This is very interesting. Hahu livatar de'idivak. That in Deuteronomy refers to after it was sewn together, meaning Rabbi Yochanan says the Torah was originally given in sections or pieces. Eventually, Moses sewed it all together, right? In modern Hebrew, idivak would mean glued it together, but of course it wasn't glued, it was sewn. We assume it was parchment that was sewn together, okay? And only then in Deuteronomy does it say this book of the Torah, meaning prior to that, prior to Moses putting the pieces together, everyone stay with me, prior to Moses putting the pieces together, it was not one unitary Torah. It was different pieces. They were, I think Rabbi Yochanan would probably say they were revealed to Moses, but they were not revealed all at once. They were revealed in pieces. And there's a quote later on in this argument right here. Rabbi Levi says, eight specific parshiot or sections were given to Moses on the day when the Mishkan was erected, which we've been reading about the last few weeks in Shul. And these are what they are, particularly laws having to do with the Mishkan. Okay, meaning, oh no, certain sections of the Torah were given at certain times to Moses. Other sections were given at other times. By the way, there's another rabbinic passage, which I couldn't lay my hands on last night to put it in the source sheet, which says Moshe, God actually dictated the different parshiot to Moses, and Moses had leave to arrange them in the order that he saw fit. Wow. Okay. Totally different view of Moshe's role. Very different than Moshe is the secretary. Still, Moshe is the secretary. He writes every word down, but it was given at different times in different pieces, and Moses had permission from God to arrange the order of the Torah of these pieces the way he saw fit. Everyone follow me? Okay. So we're having some cracks or daylight wiggle room in this idea of everything was dictated. Now let's look at a statement that goes further from Tractate Sota. Rabbi Yishmael says, and it's not entirely clear what this means, klalot with a kaf, not a kuf. With a kuf, it would mean the curses, brachot uklalot, but it's with a kaf for those who are listening to this and not reading it. Klalot ne'emru b'sinai upratot be'ohel mo'ed. The general statements or general principles were given at Sinai and the specifics later at the Tent of Meeting. Doesn't say what are the generalities and what are the specifics. Now, in the English translation, you'll see they say general mitzvot includes the Ten Commandments and the details of the mitzvot were explained to Moses at a later time. That's the English interpolation in Sepharia here. Bolded me in the English means those are the words in the Talmud, and non-bolded in the English means those are the words of interpretation. Okay. So the words of interpretation is not what it says in the Talmud. All it says in the Talmud is that generalities were spoken at Sinai, specifics later on in the Tent of Meeting. Rabbi Akiva disagrees with Rabbi Yishmael, as he always does about Torah. And he says, no. Klalot upratot ne'emru b'Sinai. The generalities and all the specifics of the mitzvot were given at Sinai, meaning Rabbi Akiva seems to be articulating what I referred to before as the maximalist position, all given at Sinai. Again, it doesn't say every word of the Torah, but there's an implication that there is a much larger revelation at Sinai to Moses than what Rabbi Yishmael is saying. But there's disagreement, and they're Tanaim. They are same level sages around the time of the Bar Kokhba rebellion. Okay, I'll pause for Michael's question, then I want to do one more passage. Yeah.
I don't know which came first, this piece of Talmud or Rabbi Ishmael's principles of interpretation, but one or the other was probably in response to the other. You know, he probably, if this is his view of how it was given in generalizations, then that would give rise to his need to have an exposition of how you interpret.
An interpretory apparatus, yes. Although, of course, probably most of the commentators would say, oh, this is not about the written Torah. They're talking about the oral Torah. Right. But the text itself here that we have in front of us is not entirely clear about that. Right. And I'm not talking about that also about the fact that, you know, the sages say two Torahs were given at Sinai, written Torah and oral Torah. And oral Torah is our Mishnah, basically, which was given at Sinai. This is their claim for the Mosaic or Sinaitic authority of the Mishnah, the oral Torah, saying this too was given at Sinai to Moses, but was transmitted orally through the ages, right? And Rabbi Yishmael would say, and what was transmitted along with it was there certain principles about how to understand the written Torah. Thank you, Michael. Okay. So, but I'd like to point out we have different views. We're when I say beginning to see, it's not that I'm not going in historical order here. I'm just going in the order on my sheet. In the order on my sheet, we're beginning to see different views about what was the Torah given to Moses, right? So the maximalist view is dictated word for word, even including the last eight verses where it says, and Moses died. But we have other views as given one portion at a time. And Moses was allowed to arrange them. Or the last eight verses were written by Joshua. By the way, the medieval commentator, Ibn Ezra, is very mysterious about this. He actually says he refers to something as the secret of the 12, which he believed that there were actually 12 verses in the Torah that were not written by Moses, but were added later on. Okay, but he's very... expresses it in a very cloaked, opaque kind of way because he knows that it's a potentially heretical idea. Okay. And now I mentioned this passage last week, so I wanted to bring it this week. Moses went up to heaven at the time of the giving of the Torah, and he saw God putting crowns on the Torah. By the way, I read an article about this a few months ago. We think that the crowns on the Torah are in a Torah scroll, the Lamed has a little thing on it, and certain letters have certain things. And apparently those are not the crowns on the Torah, because the Torah scroll that we have with the little doodads on top of the letters is not actually how it was written in those times. And apparently the crowns on the Torah means a different thing. But whatever, it means little marks on the Torah. So God was adding a little marks to the Torah. And Moshe said, why are you doing this? Right? And God said, well, Adam Echad Yesh Ba'atid Liot Besof Kamatorot. There's going to be a man in a whole bunch of generations, and his name is going to be Akiva Ben Yosef, meaning Rabbi Akiva. She'atid Lidrosh Al Kol Kotz V'Kotz Tilin Tilin V'Shel Halachot. On every single little doodad on the Torah, he is going to make drashot, meaning Rabbi Akiva is so studies Torah so deeply that not only does every et or key get an interpretation or ha in front of a word, right? But every single letter, and in fact, even each crown on the letters is going to be a source of a drasha for Rabbi Akiva. Moshe says, wow, God, har ehuli, I'd like to see that. I'd like to see that guy. Amarlo chazor la'acharecha. He said to him, turn around. It was magic. He turned around, and where was Moses? He was in Rabbi Akiva's yeshiva. Halach v'yashav v'sof shmone shirot. He sat in the eighth row, which seems to be the last row. He went and sat in the back of the classroom, right? V'lo haya yodea ma hem omrim. He did not understand anything they were saying. They're having a discussion in the Beit Midrash about Torah, and Moses, at the Torah given to Moses, and Moses does not understand anything in the discussion. Tashash kocho, his strength waned. He felt bad. Wow. This is guy Akiva who's explaining the Torah, and I don't understand any of it. Right. So somehow this made Moshe feel bad. Kevan shehigiel davar echad. Rabbi Akiva got up to a certain thing he was teaching. Amrulo talmidav Rabbi minayin lach. And the student said, Rabbi, how do you know that? Whatever law he was teaching at the moment. Amar lahen halacha lemoshe misinai. This is a law given to Moses at Sinai. Nityashva daato. Moshe's mind was restored. He put him back in an okay mood. Okay, he returned to his strength. And we know the story goes on about Rabbi Akiva's martyrdom, but I'm not doing that part of the story. Meaning, there's something which is considered part of revelation. It's not even considered part of revelation. It's considered part of revelation, and it's actually considered part of Moshe's Torah, which is somehow so far removed from Moshe's Torah that Moshe himself does not understand it. You'd sort of have to ask yourself, how could it be part of Moshe's Torah that Moses does not understand? Okay? I mean, one thing is they were probably having a discussion in Rabbi Akiva's academy in Aramaic, because that's the language that people spoke day to day, even though the Mishnah itself is in Hebrew, right? So there's stuff going on Moshe does not understand. And he hears Rabbi Akiva say, you know what? It's from Moses' Torah. So this is a midrashic way of saying, and I probably skipped a few steps in between the last passage and this passage, that there is a whole interpretive, let's call it tradition, which links all sorts of teachings to Sinai and Moses, even though they may not actually, I'm going to say factually or literally, have been given at Sinai or from Moses? Because obviously Moshe could not have delivered a piece of Torah that he himself did not understand, unless you want to explain this story in some sort of very, very roundabout, complicated kind of way that I don't think the story will bear up to that explanation, right? So there's something which Moshe has never heard of before, which is called, this is part of the Torah of Moses from Sinai. Doesn't mean it's part of the Chumash, what we call the Chumash, the Torah, the Pentateuch, the five books, but it derives somehow straight from Sinai and from Moses, which means there are things that come from Sinai. I'm trying to think to say this sentence in as precise a way as possible. And if any of you can think of a better way of saying it than I can, that would be great. There's something that comes from Moses at Sinai that is attributed to Moses at Sinai that Moses at Sinai did not actually say or teach. It is somehow derived from the Mosaic Sinaitic revelation, but it is not actually concretely from Moshe's revelation. I'm going to stop the screen sharing. So, and of course, as I foreshadowed mentioning last week, this is something that modern, later theologians, contemporary theologians, are going to take and run with. By the way, there's another passage, I didn't include it, maybe I'll put it in a revised version, that not only the words of the written Torah, and not only the words of the oral Torah, but every single discussion that every Torah student in future generation would have with their master, all those discussions were revealed to Moses at Sinai, right? Again, we would say like, ooh, that's hyperbole. So maybe it's hyperbole to make a particular theological point, which is that, I mean, and it might be the sages just wanting to say all of our discussions have God's / Moshe's / Sinai authority. So it may be hyperbole to reinforce their own authority. That would be kind of a reasonable or perhaps somewhat cynical interpretation. Okay. But even if that is the interpretation, that still has very significant, I would call them theological repercussions about revelation, meaning there are things that are considered part of Moshe's revealed Torah, the Torah revealed to Moses, that Moses himself may not actually have said, because Moshe hears them and doesn't understand them, right? So there are contemporary theologians who we will read eventually who really take this and run with it. Tamar Ross in particular, who is a feminist theologian in Israel, who has a concept of what she calls it as unfolding revelation, which is, I expressed this last week, my analogy is like, you came from your DNA, okay? And your DNA created, I'm created in air quotes, you, okay? Somehow you are an expression of your DNA, even though to our first approximation, that is unfathomable. Well, how could you say that, you know? Michael H., he's a person. How could you say he came from a double-stranded helix of four base pairs are arranged in a particular way with 23 sets of chromosomes? Like, what are you talking about? How could that be Michael H.? Okay. So somehow that's my best analogy of the Torah at Sinai, Moshe's Torah, whatever that was, which there's disagreement about it, what it was revealed, how it was revealed, is somehow the DNA and the discussion we are having today, says Tamar Ross, is the unfolding revelation, which is actually, this is the important part theologically, which is actually a part of God's revelation. We modern people, we secular-minded people would say, no, 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 that's just something that Rabbi Akiva has received and claiming that it came from Sinai. No, 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 that's just a discussion that we're having, that we're fabricating imaginatively that it came from Sinai. Okay, that's what a That's how a secular person would respond to that statement. Okay. But theologically, I think the attempt of that passage is to say, no, no, no. That law of Rabbi Akiva's that Moshe has never heard of is Mosaic from Sinai. It is part of divine revelation. I'm going to pause and let people sort of comment, ask, and digest. I think Larry is the first hand up.
I just wanted to say, although, as you know, I have difficulty with taking in any literal sense these midrashim, the concept of the originator of an idea or a Torah, not understanding a later explication of that idea is very common. If Einstein were to sit in a physics class today, and the professor would be saying, and this is Einsteinian physics or whatever it happens to be, there are many aspects of that that he would say, what is he talking about? Because Einstein famously was not a great mathematician, apparently, did not put his theories in the mathematic rigor that later physicists did. Nonetheless, it was the source of the origin, the idea itself, or the ideas themselves, do go back to Einstein. So I have no, and that's true for many, many fields of study. So I don't have any difficulty with that aspect of the Midrash.
Okay. Thank you. Except there's a difference, which is the only difference in your analogy is that Einstein was a person who lived at time X within our historical memory. So we're not making a theological statement about it. Whereas if we say this goes back to Sinai, we're making a statement of religious belief that theoretically carries some different weight to it. You know, so like, mathematicians say, well, that idea is Einsteinian. Well, that's not really Einsteinian because da 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 da. But, you know, it's kind of, I would just say, oh, religiously not. That's just me, right? I'm not a mathematician. Maybe mathematicians would say I'm wrong. Religiously, there's not much at stake there. Whereas if I say this is actually an aspect of God's revelation, there's more at stake there. This is actually an aspect of God's revelation, as opposed to, let's say, the counter argument, which is, no, you just made that up. Tamar Ross talks about this in feminism, counting women in a minion, et cetera, et cetera. So some people say, like, no, you just made that up. It's a change. It's not part of revelation. All right. Versus, oh, the revelation unfolds in ways that, I'm going to go back to the last midrash, in ways that may not have been 100% evident to someone present at the point zero of revelation, ground zero of revelation. But that still somehow have some divine authority to them.
Can I just say that's a good point, a fair point, and I can't question that. You're right. So that's why I said at the beginning, while I have difficulties understanding, taking literally I won't say it's not even the Midrash. Obviously, I reject the whole concept of godly revelation and this was given by God. But having said that, the debate about what is truly authentic about interpretations of, let's say, Judaism, how the rabbis are interpreting what's going on, is to me still similar to the way in which, now let me switch analogies, the way in which the Supreme Court might say, this is the traditional way of understanding the Constitution. Is you've got to make one feels compelled to make the argument. My argument is connected back to that, and it's actually inherent. It's intrinsic.
Good.
In that document, in that understanding.
Yeah.
So
I'd say logically, those are both analogies. Yes. And that second one that you're giving is a somewhat better analogy because, again, that's more about authority, right? As opposed to like, well, you know, Einstein thought that. Oh, no, he didn't. You came up with that later. I don't know. But whereas the Supreme Court is about authority. And I'd like to point out what's part of the Torah is really a big issue of authority, potentially, and meaning. Okay, pause. Other questions, comments, thoughts? All right. I think I'm going to let it hang, and we might do more on this next week. And I think we're in the clear for, I think, several weeks. I think there's probably 3 weeks between, I think there's 3 weeks between now and Pesach, three Tuesdays between now and Pesach. I might be wrong about that. Maybe there are four. Okay. Let's all mull this over. We'll have more next week. Thank you all. Have a healthy day. Be Torah and pray for world peace.
You have been listening to another in our series of podcasts from Temple Beth Am, a dynamic center for conservative Judaism in Los Angeles. If you enjoy these podcasts, we invite you to write a review on the Apple Podcast site or wherever you get your podcasts. For more information about Temple Beth Am, Los Angeles, go to tbala.org.